Up next, some incredible stories of forbidden knowledge. Dr. Frank Albo joins us, and we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Frank Albo with us, architectural historian. He's an expert on communicating new streams of knowledge in relation to the environment and the cultures of the deep past. His approach to architecture, landscape design seeks to transform public spaces into interactive journeys of discovery, which elevate the mind and promote a sense of wonder and inspiration. His book is called Astana, Architect, Myth, and Destiny. And Frank, welcome back to the program. Good to have you again.
It's wonderful to be on your show, George.
When we call you an architectural historian, what is that?
Well, it's a specialized field of history, wherein you look at buildings as a way of understanding culture, just in the same way that you would examine a text. In particular, my passion is for looking at the built environment in such a way that you could see what is being built with a new set of glasses if you know how to understand the language of architecture. So it's, you know, for the casual observer, they'll look at buildings, monuments, cemeteries, but with historical eyes, you can see it entirely differently. It's like a way of understanding our cultural DNA through the built environment.
There was an episode for you that changed you. It was looking at the Egyptian Sphinx. What happened?
Well, that was an event that took place about 13 years ago by sheer accident. It was in my hometown of Winnipeg when one day, out of the corner of my eye, I spotted two Egyptian sphinxes on the roof of the legislative building in Manitoba. And I simply parked my car, looked up, and tried to answer why there were these sphinxes on the roof of a neoclassical building. And that one question changed my life forever, because it set me down a rabbit hole of discovery and enchantment, trying to understand the mind of the brilliant architect who designed the building, who, it turns out, was not only a Freemason, but who had an extraordinary command of biblical languages, ancient knowledge, and deposited an entire library of coded messages inside this building. And if it wasn't for noticing that Sphinx, I never would have journeyed throughout and spent about 4 graduate degrees and 10 years trying to figure out the mind of this genius.
Frank, how many people figured out what this architect was up to?
Well, nobody.
you were the only woman.
Yeah, he left us a bit of an architectural Sudoku puzzle, and it almost gives me goosebumps today to think about a detail that he left us about 100 years ago when he said, you know, I've left this province a great and lasting memorial, but perhaps only one person in 100 years will truly figure out the mysteries of the Manitoba Ledge. That's how we affectionately refer to it. And it was just amazing. It can't get any more romantic than seeing a Sphinx and trying to answer the riddle of it. But that's what happened.
Why are there so many riddles of past works where we can figure it out? Sometimes we can't. But why do they put them in myths and riddles?
Well, myth is an extraordinary, powerful tool to enchant the mind. And architecture, among all disciplines of the human mind, has the capacity to really engage you. And, Winston Churchill once said that we build our buildings and then our buildings build us. And whether it's a local architect or the great pyramid builders, they know that the monumentality of these great structures actually has a command on our soul.
Interesting. Now, when you were doing some of this work and you're still doing it, it's turned now into a television show, hasn't it?
Well, it's presently being under consideration by History Channel. I have a show that's called Forbidden Knowledge that looks into our cultural rich past. And I called this Forbidden Knowledge because we see Western civilization as resting on two twin pillars. On the one hand, there's Greek rationalism, which gives us empiricism, philosophy, and science. And on the other, we have biblical faith, so the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, between these two is a tremendous body of wisdom, a body of wisdom that stretches back all the way from ancient Alexandria to modern secret societies. And this body of wisdom deals with the notion that through the faculty of our intellect alone, we could understand the mysteries of nature. And this has led to the formation of mystical schools of thought like Kabbalah or alchemy, but it has also had profound achievements in science as well. Right. This extraordinary moment. Anyways, sorry, go ahead.
No. You're doing great. But your book is called Astana. Isn't that the capital of Kazakhstan?
That's true. It's a city widely hailed the Illuminati capital of the world. And if you look at it on the surface, you could see why somebody could be led to this association. It is full of these most otherworldly buildings. I mean, the world's largest outdoor tent, a giant UFO, literally a giant UFO, a massive glass pyramid, the largest spherical building, and one building in particular, which is unapologetically in the shape of an all-seeing eye. So for somebody looking in, they see this extraordinary building project, the greatest building project since the foundations of Rome, and you can be led to the only one conclusion. That is, surely this is the masterwork of the Illuminati. And being that my subject matter of interest and specialization was secret societies and architecture, it became a subject of obsession for me for about 4 years, and then I published the book, Astana.
How influential do you think the Illuminati might be worldwide?
I think that they largely... It's today, the original historical origins of the Illuminati are decidedly different than the popular enchantment is mm-hmm. of the Illuminati. The Illuminati was formed in 1776 by a charismatic professor who rounded together a small coterie of students that sought to look at the works of Enlightenment philosophy. It was basically like the 18th century German equivalent of Berkeley Flower Power. And their initial impulse was with political aspirations to overthrow the government and, in particular, overthrow the Roman Catholic Church that was controlling secular education. They had a very, very short-lived existence. They operated from about 1785 to being entirely disbanded by 1790. And after, the fateful events of 1790 led to the French Revolution. And through a number of tabloid journalists, they pointed to the Illuminati saying, this organization in Bavaria, started by German Freemasons, were the secret engineers to the French Revolution, and that that mystique of them has existed for the last 200 years. So for the most part, and I'm not here to extol the virtues of the Illuminati in any sense, but they were their principal aim was moral perfection and having very close readings of the godfathers of the Enlightenment like Rousseau and Adam Smith. They were basically a student group almost similar to what we would describe today as Occupy Wall Street or something like that.
Aren't they everywhere these days?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the initial impulse of the Illuminati as a historical organization was really short-lived and highly ineffectual. They went through a number of series of rebirths by other quasi-secret societies that glommed on to its notorious past, but in no way, shape, or form had any direct genealogical relationship.
None at all?
None.
Are they evil people, Frank?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're living in the 18th century and all of your knowledge is dictated through the corpus of learning from the church, and you want to disassociate with that and read books on the historicity of the earth, biblical criticism, the other works of the Enlightenment, you might find yourself actually being akin to what is the initial impulse of the Illuminati. But yeah, they were What made them so interesting is that they took on the trope and rituals of Freemasonry and dovetailed them to this aspiration to overthrow the church. The one legacy, the one living, I think, real living legacy of the Illuminati is secular education today. That was probably, for centuries, millennia, our knowledge was largely predicated on what the church had told us.
How many members do you think are in the Illuminati today?
Well, their initial membership was around 2,000. As a historian of secret societies, I looked at the examine the texts of the original order. Today, it's I don't see a official membership per se. It's largely a countercultural obsession that has attracted, you know, the giants of the hip hop industry to, you know, everyday people that have attached themselves to this mystique. But as a formal organization, as they once were, it's decidedly different than any type of manifestation of the Illuminati today.
I'm amazed at this forbidden knowledge and the way they have hidden things in symbols and architecture and things like that. Why did they hide them?
It's a very good point. Chiefly two reasons. In the one sense, the notion is, and this is inherited from Freemasonry, is that the knowledge that they are presenting is so sacred that it cannot be just freely given to the profane. It has to go through an initiatic system from master to disciple. The other element to this is that it's actually very much rooted in the Christian faith, for instance, the idea that some knowledge can be given in the form of parables and riddles, as Jesus spoke. And on the other hand, there was the body of secret wisdom that Jesus only gave to his closest elect, like the central three, James, Peter, and John the Beloved. You know, there's a line, I think it's in Mark, where he says, to them I speak in parables, but to you, the central three, I give the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And it's this idea that certain knowledge is so important and sacred that it cannot be profaned. So the question is, what is that knowledge? And it's simple, that the mind, that this divine spark of reason has the capacity to read the book of natures and all the mysteries within. Today, it doesn't sound so forbidden, but in ancient times and right up into probably the beginning of the French Revolution, that was seen as highly contentious.
Some would say that even today, the things that are hidden away, the symbols and things like that, are done because of something that could happen in the future, and they don't want us to know about it. I mean, could they be sending messages to their members that way?
Well, one of the most profound tools of being able to record knowledge is not through discursive reasoning, but through symbols. In many respects, our mind operates in a symbolic vocabulary. So if you did want to deposit a body of wisdom for a future time, not using any type of standard trope or English or root learning, the vocabulary of symbols, myth in particular, and architecture are great tools.
Yep, they sure are. Could you say that the Bible itself was a tool of myth and symbols?
Well, there are three ways of looking at this. When the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Bible took place in the 2nd century BCE in Alexandria, there was a great discourse about what would happen by translating the original writing from Hebrew into Greek. And the debate centered on this, that by the very act of translating from Hebrew, a sacred language, into any other language would profane in some way, lose the marrow of the text. So what we've inherited from this is that there are the translated, seemingly superficial stories, like the story of Balaam's ass or Balaam's donkey. deeper still are allegorical messages beneath them. And then at the letter level of the Bible, both in Greek and in Hebrew, there is a whole other reading of the text. For instance, if you take the very first book of Genesis, the first verse of Genesis, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth.
Which is a great opening.
That opening, the heavens, it's actually the gods, by the way. It's Elohim, which means not God. We get it translated as God, but it's actually a plural word. It means the gods. And that's just one nuance that changes the entire meaning of the text. Not only that, but the first 27 characters can be broken up into different words altogether. We've inherited by tradition that it is in the beginning that God's created the heaven and the earth. But in fact, at the letter level, every single Hebrew character has no spaces. So it's just a string of letters that have been brought up by convention to be read in the English version we know today.
When you were doing your work, what was for you the most shocking thing that you came across?
The very notion that myth does not exclusively deal with the fable of the gods. In fact, myth is an essential part of the human imagination, and it's embedded in psychology, art, philosophy, our films, and that we largely see myth today as being synonymous with a lie. But myth from the very foundations of Western civilization to today has been a tool of, in some cases, higher learning, and in other cases, mind control.
Mind control?
Well, yes.
Almost like the Manchurian candidates.
Precisely. Yeah, the fables that we tell and the way we tell stories is one that should have equal footing with rational, logical philosophy, and in some cases has even a more profound role in governing society than science. And this is something that was very much at the heart of J.R.R. Tolkien's project, The Lord of the Rings, and several other secret societies that employed myth, the power of myth. I mean, one could say that the very idea of manifest destiny, the notion that by providential decree that the settlers could move to the West, is a myth, and that myth today has percolated already into the heart of American politics and at many other levels. We have our own politics here in Canada, but the notion behind these myths is really what, in many ways, governs the world.
Frank's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back in a moment, we're going to talk about Solomon's Temple and why that is so important to Freemasonry and also his research and his story. Later on tonight, he wants to give away a couple books based on two puzzles. If the first person can solve the riddle, they'll get a free copy of his book, Astana. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on as well. We'll talk deeply, too, about some more of these methods of myths and symbols that they've got hidden away as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Frank Albo with us. Frank, let's talk about the significance of Solomon's Temple, which was destroyed in 587 BC by Nebuchadnezzar II. Why does this temple mount, this temple, have such a meaning?
Well, since the destruction of the temple, and bear this in mind, the temple is God's first and only architectural project. And more than any other created thing, we know more about the details, construction, dimensions, proportions of the temple than, biblically speaking, the creation of the sun, the moon, and the stars. And because of this level of biblical detail, the temple has been mined as a repository of ancient knowledge. The great scientist Isaac Newton spent many years trying to decipher the plans in the Book of Kings of King Solomon's Temple. He even translated it from Hebrew. But In Freemasonry, the temple has an altogether different mystique. It is part of a model for the reformation of the world. This lost ideal of the destruction of the temple by the hands of Nebuchadnezzar had basically altered and changed the world. And they build an entire myth around the chief architect of the temple, who is in the possession of this secret knowledge given to him directly from God of how to build this microcosm of the universe. And through the ritual grades of Freemasonry, they remember the temple. And in many respects, this enduring image of the temple is still with us today. If you've ever been inside of the Sistine Chapel, the dimensions of the Sistine Chapel are a perfect moniker of the dimensions of Solomon's Temple, the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris. These are all reconstructions of King Solomon's Temple, namely because it was destroyed, it was this lost ideal, it becomes a microcosm of the universe, a way of accessing a kind of blueprint to the mind of God. And in the most bizarre ways, the temple has been part of our architectural vocabulary, and there's various ways to see it. I teach my students that anytime you see two distal columns in antis, which are two columns at the entrance above an entablature, that is a reflection of the original temple and the two columns of Jachin and Boaz that sit at the entrance of Solomon's temple. And even bizarrely, even more bizarrely, configurations of the temple even found their way in the planning of Auschwitz.
Really?
That's correct.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, far from being a mere hodgepodge of like some extermination camp, the 17th century reconstructions of the temple were modeled on Auschwitz, that the exact spot of the inner sanctum, or what we call the Holy of Holies, is the precise location of the gas chambers. It's a very haunting image.
Was Auschwitz, Frank, built to be the concentration camp that it was, or was it something else first?
Yeah, it was meant to be an elite German workers' camp, but this notion of the temple, the sacralization of the temple being employed for this nefarious purpose is, you know, part of the mystique and heritage of the temple in a variety of ways, from Masonic lodges to Auschwitz. It's remarkable to think that a single building has had this much influence on the human imagination.
Tell me about this treasure hunt that's kind of tucked away in your book, Astana.
Well, yeah, so my book on Astana deals with the architecture of this most extraordinary $60 billion project, which is presently underway in the homeland of Borat, I tend to say. But what I wanted to do was to engage my audience to understand, to read the text deeper than a superficial reading. I've placed a series of enigmas, clues, and secrets, symbols within the text, hoping that somebody will carefully read it, read between the lines, and discover the hidden message. And if you discover the hidden message, you win this extraordinary prize, $5,000, two first-class tickets to visit the Illuminati capital of the world, plus 7 nights in a remarkable five-star hotel.
Interesting take. That's fascinating. We're going to take calls next hour with Frank as we talk about myths and symbols. Would you say that this area, Astana, is the greatest spot for these symbols than any place on the planet, or are there other spots too?
I don't think that there is any part, whether conceived or built, that has employed the power of architecture and the mystique of symbols any more powerfully than this city.
Interesting take. But why that city of all the places on this planet?
I would say plumb very deeply my book, which, by the way, I sent you a copy. I hope you received it. And yeah. I'd be delighted to this evening give out several more. So there is a Astana has a very, or Kazakhstan has a very rich history. This particular area has a very rich history. I open my book by showing three monumental, little-known discoveries that happened in the last 10 years in Kazakhstan. Number one, the world's largest outdoor pentagram. Number two, the largest and perhaps first swastika illustrated on the ground in a massive geoglyph. And even more recently, the unearthing of giant step pyramids from around 1200 BCE. So pyramids, pentagram, swastika, recently unearthed in Kazakhstan.
Jeez. In that order?
The timeline? Not exactly, but yes. So I use that as a way of engaging the reader to say, look closely at the least among cities. There's a trope in the Synoptic Gospels where the least among cities, there's no way the Messiah could be born in Bethlehem, the house of bread, the least among cities. And the agency of the last place that you'd expect to find it is part of a plot device that I use in the book.
Now, what would you call this kind of symbolism or architecture? Is there a name for it?
The style of architecture?
Yeah.
In Astana? Well, it blends many different styles. It's Eurasian, it's Russian Baroque, it's neoclassical, it's brutalist. It's a melange of many different architectural styles representing a kind of potpourri of religious belief. The area where Astana is today was the nexus of the crossroads called the Great Silk Road. And through this Great Silk Road, the cultures of the East and West blended. Kazakhstan is not East and it's not West. It is in the heart of Central Asia. And it has gleaned from, borrowed from, the traditions and cultures of the past for thousands of years. It was under the Persians, the Mongols, the Turks, the Soviet Union for 250 years. They finally gained their independence, and the first thing they do is build this remarkable city from scratch. It's the first, the last fully planned from scratch tabula rasa architectural capital.
How did you find this, you know, beyond the Egyptian Sphinx episode that changed your life? How did you find all these things?
Well, it's looking for symbols, and the progeny thereof is very much part of what I do.
I mean, do you look at the back of a dollar bill with the all-seeing eye and stuff like that?
Well, that's been part of my training, is to look at things beyond their superficial reading. And therein, by the way, lies the deeper message. So it initially began by looking at biblical languages, where I did my first graduate degree, and then it moved into the area of art and architecture.
Fascinating. Do you know Jordan Maxwell by any chance?
I don't.
You would hit it off with him, because he is deep into these symbols and mythology.
Well, I'd be delighted to if you'd connect me.
I remember when I was a kid, I would look at the back of comic books and things, and I would see ads for joining the Rosicrucians.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they, and why would they advertise on comic books?
Well, that version of the Rosicrucians were probably the ancient and mystical order of the Rosy Cross, which is another variation of the original Brotherhood, which was concocted entirely in myth. This is little known about the Rosicrucian Brotherhood, but that they emerged from a cadre of heterodox Lutheran intellectuals in the 17th century that were trying to combat the greatest terror that ever befell Europe, which was the 30 Years' War. It's the longest and most brutal war in the history of Europe, about 8 million casualties, and it was marked by the fight between Catholic and Protestant forces. And out of this enormous turmoil, this group of scholars got together and concocted the myth of the Rosicrucian Brotherhood, the idea that there was existing in secret an invisible college of healers, of workers that were trying to make right, offer a solution to this great trauma of the time. They were trying to unite medicine and philosophy and spiritual alchemy as all part of this quest for creating what they called a new world order, the reformation of the world. The entire thing was a clever hoax.
A hoax? Really?
Oh, yes. It was a concocted hoax. But this experiment had profound implications. They never expected that by the very invention of this myth, founded by an even greater myth, the Christian Rosenkreuz, the so-called founder of the Rosicrucians, that they would garner such an extraordinary reaction from the intellectuals of the day. So a number of letters were being written saying, I too want to join the mystical order of the Rosy Cross. And they kind of cloaked their myth in symbols with the hope that it would create, it's sort of like a publicity stunt, really. And little did they know that it would have such a huge impact, perhaps to this day, the greatest publicity stunt of the last 300 years was the complete full-scale invention that there was an invisible college operating among us, trying to heal the sick, work for free, unite philosophy, science, the combat of religions, and many years later, about a century later, an actual secret society was formed called the Rosicrucians, built upon this original myth. Freemasons did a very similar thing in the myth of Hiram Abiff, the so-called builder of King Solomon's temple.
Where did the Knights Templar fit in with any of this?
Well, we have the historical order of the Knights Templar, and then we have the myth that the Knights Templar were part of the genealogy of ancient Freemasonry. There has been zero historical evidence that Freemasonry, speculative Freemasonry that we describe today, has any direct or even indirect connection to the these noble knights trying to rid Jerusalem, put Jerusalem back into Christian hands.
Why do we all think, most people, that the Freemasonry groups, Freemasons, are somewhat evil? People think that.
Largely misinterpretation, sensationalism, and the idea that on the one hand, Masons claim to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, the very notion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the battle cry of 18th century democracy, emerged for the first time in Masonic lodges. We have to give that to them. And on the other hand, you have many powerful people that have joined Masonic lodges. So the element behind Freemasonry is the very notion of secrecy is something that we find abhorrent. But what is the real secret of Freemasonry became the subject of my dissertation. I wanted to look at it in the same way that an anthropologist would look and study a foreign culture. I thought that most of the literature in Freemasonry was either marred by these two trends, Masons claiming that we had invented the notion of liberal democracy, and on the other hand, others espousing that they are a nefarious secret society plotting to take over the world. And I wanted to step into the fray and offer a sensible academic approach to this amazing phenomenon, which was the birth of speculative Freemasonry and how it changed the Enlightenment and modern thinking.
Frank, when we come back, we're going to flip a switch and open up the phone lines, giving this incredible audience an opportunity to chat with you. Dr. Frank Elbow with us, and of course, his book is called Astana.